Chapter 5. The Fakes President. Donald Trump and Art. The verdict against the sitting president of the United States of America was a fine of $2 million. Moreover, he was ordered to dissolve his family foundation and transfer its assets to an organization that was actually directed toward the social good. It must have been especially painful for Donald Trump that it was a piece of art that led to this exceedingly embarrassing penalty. No U.S. president has so aggressively advertised his anti-intellectualism or proved as antagonistic toward culture as Donald Trump. This U.S. president never had an emotional attachment to visual art, but rather a strategic relationship, one that was not always legal. That differentiates him from most of his predecessors. When artworks and artists were pleasing decorative elements and useful to him, he happily surrounded himself with them. And when it served his purposes, he violated agreements and rules time and again. There are countless examples. Thus, for instance, there are several photos from the 1980s that depict Trump and Ivana, his wife at the time, with Andy Warhol. The world-famous artist eventually developed a real antipathy toward Trump, as Warhol's meetings with him also concerned commissioned work and payment thereof, and the relationship soured. On other occasions, Trump claimed that he owned a masterpiece by one of the most important artists of French Impressionism. In fact, the picture was demonstrably a copy, a forgery, or even a print. The U.S. president nonetheless claimed several times that he had the original hanging on his wall. He had other works destroyed, although he had earlier promised them to one of the most important museums in the world for its collection. And the question of how Trump paid for the rare purchases of art that he made led to the legal proceeding referred to above, financial penalties, and the dissolution of the foundation through which Trump had for decades played at being a philanthropist. In fact, as the court found, he used the Trump Foundation for private acquisitions too. False attributions, broken promises, and illegal payments tell the larger story of Donald Trump and art. Donald Trump appears to have no personal connection to visual art. For him, it's pure decoration. Other presidents consciously made political statements through their choice of pictures and sculptures for the Oval Office, but Trump had it decorated with new gold curtains. His roomy three-story apartment at the top of Trump Tower in New York is dominated by inoffensive art that is of no value, except at best as decoration. Art which a person in Trump's circle would not consider a mistake, because it's standard issue for the white upper class, just like the fake ancient columns, marble floors, fireplace clocks, heavy gathered drapery, and voluminous upholstered furniture. At least since Ronald Reagan, Republicans have had a distant relationship to contemporary art, which doesn't tell heroic, patriotic stories, communicates mostly through indirect means, and according to conservatives, tilts toward the progressive left. They still love the landscape paintings of the Hudson River School, with their topographical, identity-building themes of discovery and settlement, the kitschy, banal scenes of Norman Rockwell, the cowboy sculptures like the Bronco Buster by Frederick Remington, which likewise stood in Trump's office. From other realms of culture, there are reports of Trump's preference for straightforward action films, like those starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, Bloodsport, or easily understood musicals like Evita, which Trump has said he's seen over and over. After the show about the wife of the former dictator of Argentina concluded its Broadway run, Trump still pined for it in his 2004 book Think Like a Billionaire. My favorite Broadway show is Evita by Andrew Lloyd Webber, starring Patti LuPone. I saw it 6 times, mostly with Ivana. Evita is not on Broadway right now, but I'm hopeful that they'll bring it back. During Trump's 2016 presidential run, his campaign rallies featured music from The Phantom of the Opera, another play by Andrew Lloyd Webber, who was also Trump's former tenant. In the 1980s, on the talk show Crossfire, the businessman was asked about his favorite book. His first answer was, "I think Tom Wolfe is excellent." When host Pat Buchanan asked about Wolfe's current bestseller, The Bonfire of the Vanities, which he mistakenly called Vanity of the Bonfires, Trump answered that he hadn't read the book. Then the conversation segued into the following dialogue, with Buchanan and his co-host, Tom Braden, asking what book his guest was currently reading, as reported by the news website Political Flair. "I'm reading my own book again because I think it's so fantastic." And Buchanan pressed him to name the best book you've read beside Art of the Deal. "I really liked Tom Wolfe's last book," Trump replied, "and I think he's a great author. He's done a beautiful job." "Which book?" Buchanan asked. Trump: "His current book." Buchanan: "Bonfire of the Vanities." Trump: "Yes, and the man has done a very, very good job, and I really can't hear with this earphone, by the way." On several occasions, Trump named the Bible as his favorite book. When Bloomberg Television asked about his favorite passage, Trump was unable to name even one. "Trump seems utterly confused in even defining the word culture," commented Virginia Shore about the president's preferences. Shore was formerly the chief curator of the State Department's Art in Embassies program, which since 1963 has commissioned U.S. art for foreign embassies and consulates as a mean of cross-cultural diplomacy. "I wish the president would spend time in a museum or gallery and learn the true meaning of culture." The president's distant relationship with art quickly bore consequences. During his first year in office, the 16 artists, architects, and writers who sat on the president's Committee on the Arts unanimously resigned out of protest against the inappropriate comments by the president after the Nazi demonstration in Charlottesville, at which a woman was killed and 19 people were severely injured. He maintained that leftist demonstrators were also guilty in these terrible events. "I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either. But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides." A spokeswoman for the White House announced tersely after the resignation of these experts that the president had already planned to wind down the committee. Charity money for Trump portraits. Donald Trump obviously likes one type of artwork so much that he has been ready to spend money on it several times in the past, even if the money wasn't his own. These artworks aren't abstract or even political, but objective, very concrete, and, for Trump, transparent and easy to understand. They depict him. The society painter Ralph Wolf Cowan suggested painting his portrait in 1989. Trump didn't make a commission, but signaled his agreement, after which Cowan presented him with several oil sketches. Some of Cowan's other subjects had been the Philippine dictator's wife, Imelda Marcos, the Sultan of Brunei, and King Hassan II of Jordan. The journalist Nicole Pasulka described Cowan's flattering style of painting. "In his paintings, people are 20 pounds thinner and 20 years younger, often surrounded by heavenly light, riding exotic animals, or framed by mountain ranges." The artist himself calls his style romantic realism. He portrayed Trump in a white tennis outfit beneath a somber sky from which presumably divine light shines down upon the earth. The title of the embarrassing painting was packed with heavy-handed symbolism: The Visionary. Mark Bowden, who much earlier wrote about the future president for Playboy magazine, analyzed why Trump, like other powerful men, fall for such art. "The kind of painter he can appreciate, one who truly sees Trump the way he sees himself in the mirror, is West Palm Beach artist Ralph Wolf Cowan, whose sun god portrait of Donald hangs in the library at Mar-a-Lago. Cowan's portrait depicts a wide-shouldered, thin-hipped Donald, his youthful face eclipsing the sun itself, his skin glowing like the top floors of Trump Tower at sunset, the color of warm bouillon." Nonetheless, there were soon problems getting paid. Cowan had deliberately left parts of the portrait as unfinished sketches. The left hand and parts of the left leg were only suggested. Trump didn't understand the artistic concept, which didn't meet his expectations of an idealized representation. "When are you going to finish my painting?" he asked the painter. Cowan replied that the picture was finished. At some point, Trump asked Cowan how much it would cost to paint in the missing parts, and Cowan gave up his concept and painted in the rest in 2002. A price of between $18,000 and $24,000 had been agreed upon for the picture. In the end, the artist gave Trump a 60% discount and opined later, "He always tried to bargain, and I don't like that at all." Trump bought more pictures of himself. For some of them, it was later revealed that the vain businessman hadn't paid for them out of his own pocket, but rather from funds that were actually set aside for completely different purposes. Even for a sitting president, that would have consequences. At a benefit auction in 2007 for the Unicorn Children's Foundation at his private club Mar-a-Lago in Florida, the millionaire bought a 4-foot-tall depiction of his head, painted by the Argentine artist Javi Schantz. Beneath his face, the lines of an architectural drawing shine through. The design was derived from a PR photo of Trump in a dark suit jacket and a blue and white tie, and with a decisive look on his face. In 2000, when Trump first toyed with running for president, it appeared on the cover of the book The America We Deserve, which was written with a ghostwriter. Trump opened the bidding at $10,000 and, to his embarrassment, remained the only bidder. The larger-than-life-size portrait of his head didn't interest anyone else. The picture was gabbled off to the person it represented. Nonetheless, Trump proudly had himself photographed with the artist and the painting on an easel after the auction. In that same year, at a society benefit at Trump's Mar-a-Lago, the so-called speed painter, Michael Israel, painted the club's owner in 5 or 6 minutes. His wife Melania at first bid $10,000 for the unkind portrait of him in a blue tie. She was convinced by the auctioneer to double the price for the benefit of the organization Children's Place at Home Safe. But the check in payment, according to an investigation by the Washington Post, didn't come from the Trumps, but rather from the Trump Foundation. According to statements from an assistant to Israel, the picture was to be sent to Trump's golf club in Westchester County in New York. Thus, money that the Trump Foundation had raised ostensibly to benefit the public good was in fact spent solely for the benefit of the foundation's president, Donald Trump, to avoid his having to personally make good on his wife's commitment to buy the painting. And that wasn't the only time this kind of thing happened. 7 years later, Trump took a liking to the portrait that William Quigley had painted of him based on the same PR photo that Javi Schantz had earlier used as his model. It was this picture that years later led criminal investigators to the trail of the money that Trump had used for many of his art buys. This time, Trump wanted to make sure that nobody should be left with the impression that only Trump was interested in buying his portrait. And he didn't want the price the portrait would bring to be so shamefully low. Trump therefore did some planning in advance, and after the auction he played at being pleasantly surprised. "Just found out that at a charity auction of celebrity portraits in East Hampton, my portrait by artist William Quigley topped list at $60,000. The real estate developer shared on Twitter on July 16, 2013. He carefully concealed that he was the one behind the alleged record price, and that, once again, he had illegally siphoned off funds from his public charity. And that wasn't the biggest problem for Trump that arose out of this auction. 4 days before Trump's tweet, Quigley's picture, a boring, large-format head-and-shoulders portrait, had been auctioned off in fashionable East Hampton on the South Fork of Long Island. The sale, which Trump apparently wanted to use to embellish his reputation, didn't take place in one of the globally recognized auction houses, such as Sotheby's, Christie's, Phillips, or Bonhams, but rather in the much humbler rooms of the artist's studio gallery. Not much earlier, Quigley had opened his space on Newtown Lane, not far from the center of the town of 21,000 people, to draw the attention of the well-to-do local citizenry to his new atelier. The artist organized an auction in connection with a reception for an exhibition called The Pleasurists. Part of the proceeds were to be given to the Guild Hall of East Hampton, a cultural center founded in 1931 that includes a small museum. According to the local newspaper, only 3 pictures were to be offered, including a portrait of the actor Ethan Hawke and that of Donald Trump. Quigley's mother had suggested that Trump might be good material, Quigley said later, and she recommended the TV show The Apprentice as a possible way to learn more about the business world. Without a commission, the painter began the portrait in 2006, a bust portrait of him in a dark suit and red tie. The style is conventional. The portrait of Trump looks almost like a photograph that's been painted over. To someone who doesn't understand very much about painting, the pseudo-expressionist brushstrokes might look daring, but in fact they aren't. The representation of Trump doesn't express in any way the artist's take on his subject. According to his own statements, Quigley finished the picture in 2011 and adjusted it quickly for age. The face didn't look quite as young as the one in the photo on which the painting was based, and orange-colored accents glowed in the subject's formerly dark hair. Mediocre pictures like this can still be seen by the dozen on William Quigley's website today. Michael Jackson, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mick Jagger, Paul Newman, Ray Charles, Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, Frank Sinatra, and so on. And Abraham Lincoln and Elvis Presley aren't the only ones who didn't know about their portraits. William Quigley told the local Weekly Hamptons newspaper, Dan's Papers, that Donald Trump had apparently gotten wind that his portrait was going to be auctioned in fashionable East Hampton, and he had expressed an interest. That's why the starting bid price was increased, the artist said, so as not to embarrass Trump. Trump didn't bid himself, as his former attorney Michael Cohen admitted 6 years later before the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, the congressional committee tasked in 2019 with investigating Trump's business practices, his connections to Russia, and the possible manipulation of the 2016 presidential election. The 52-year-old attorney, who had worked for Trump for many years and as the legal advisor for his election team, had arranged the payment of hush money to a woman who claimed to have had an affair with Trump, testified before the committee on February 27, 2019. There he provided some interesting details about the art auction in Long Island. Mr. Trump directed me to find a straw bidder to purchase a portrait of him that was being auctioned at an Art Hamptons event. The objective was to ensure that his portrait, which was to be auctioned last, would go for the highest price of any portrait that afternoon. The portrait was purchased by the fake bidder for $60,000. Mr. Trump directed the Trump Foundation, which is supposed to be a charitable organization, to repay the fake bidder, despite keeping the art for himself. Please see Exhibit 3B to my testimony. William Quigley identified the straw man bidder as Trump's friend, the billionaire Stuart Rahr, founder of the pharmaceutical company Kinray Incorporated, which was acquired at the end of 2010 for $1.3 billion by Cardinal Health Incorporated. The artist recalls that Trump paid personally. Quigley met Trump in person to pick up the check, which came out to $67,000. He was nothing but a gentleman, he recalls. The check was not, however, drawn on an account belonging to Donald Trump, as Michael Cohen testified before the U.S. Congress. In his testimony, the attorney presented, in his own words, a copy of an article with Mr. Trump's handwriting on it that reported on the auction of a portrait of himself. He arranged for the bidder ahead of time and then reimbursed the bidder from the account of his non-profit charitable foundation, with the picture now hanging in one of his country clubs. What is probably his most famous sale, the portrait of Donald Trump modeled on the PR photo, can no longer be found on Michael Quigley's website. He has stated that he donated a modest 10% of the auction price for the picture to the Guildhall of East Hampton. Not only had Trump lied in making a pretense of surprise in his tweet after the auction, he himself had orchestrated the high price and financed it. In order to benefit himself and present himself publicly in a favorable light, he had also used funds that, under the charter for his foundation, were intended for charitable purposes. This violation of the rules would have consequences for him only after he had won the election and become President of the United States, when the strange business practices of the Trump Foundation came to light, illegally financing both the vanity of its founder and his presidential campaign. In November 2017, New York State Judge Sally Ann Scarpula ordered Donald J. Trump to pay $2 million in damages for improperly using charitable assets to intervene in the 2016 presidential primaries and further his own political interests. The payment was part of a settlement in a legal proceeding against Donald Trump, his sons Donald Trump Jr. and Eric, as well as his daughter Ivanka, as New York Attorney General Letitia James explained. Chiefly, Mr. Trump admits to personally misusing funds at the Trump Foundation and agrees to restrictions on future charitable service and ongoing reporting to the Office of the Attorney General in the event he creates a new charity. The settlements also include mandatory training requirements for Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, and Eric Trump. The proceeding was halted in return for the settlement. The nonprofit, founded in 1987, had to be terminated and liquidated, however, with its remaining assets distributed to other nonprofit organizations. Absolutely gross, degenerate stuff. With respect to contemporary art in particular, Donald Trump's aesthetic horizons don't stretch far, and he's short on patience. Trump's non-relationship with visual art has yet another peculiar quality that leads him to disregard boundaries and go too far, aesthetically as well as legally. In what he claims as his autobiography, the 1987 Art of the Deal, whose true author has since revealed himself to be the journalist Tony Schwartz, Trump quite openly admitted his particular dislike of modern and contemporary art. A friend of mine, a highly successful and very well-known painter, calls to say hello and to invite me to an opening. I get a great kick out of this guy because, unlike some artists I've met, he's totally unpretentious. A few months back, he invited me to come to his studio. We were standing around talking when all of a sudden he said to me, "Do you want to see me earn $25,000 before lunch?" "Sure," I said, having no idea what he meant. He picked up a large open bucket of paint and splashed some on a piece of canvas stretched on the floor. Then he picked up another bucket, containing a different color, and splashed some of that on the canvas. He did this four times, and it took him perhaps 2 minutes. When he was done, he turned to me and said, "Well, that's it. I've just earned $25,000. Let's go to lunch." He was smiling, but he was absolutely serious. His point was that plenty of collectors wouldn't know the difference between his two-minute art and the paintings he really cares about. They were just interested in buying his name. I've always felt that a lot of modern art is a con, and that the most successful painters are often better salesmen and promoters than they are artists. I sometimes wonder what would happen if collectors knew what I knew about my friend's work that afternoon. The art world is so ridiculous that the revelation might even make his paintings more valuable. Not that my friend is about to risk finding out. Whether there ever was this painter friend, or if Trump Schwartz had only invented him as a vehicle for Trump's own populist opinions about the supposed mechanisms of the art world, is not known. Trump's prejudices are the same time and again, on those occasions when he's unable to avoid contact with the topic of art and culture. In 1999, then-New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who would later become President Trump's controversial legal advisor, threatened the Brooklyn Museum with financial consequences. As part of the exhibition Sensation, the respected museum had included provocative artworks that earlier had been shown at the Royal Academy of Arts in London and in the Hamburger Bahnhof Museum in Berlin. Among the works exhibited from the collection of the British advertising magnate Charles Saatchi, there was the painting Myra by Marcus Harvey, which was based on the police photograph of a woman who had killed children. This piece had already been defaced twice in London, once with ink and again with eggs. In particular, an assemblage entitled The Holy Virgin Mary by the British painter Chris Ofili, who is of Nigerian ancestry, was shown in the exhibition. Vehement protest erupted because of this representation, in which Mary has black skin and is depicted through a collage of pornographic magazines, but most especially because her exposed breast is made of dried elephant dung, and the picture leans against the wall, resting on two balls made of the same material. Leading the charge, Mayor Giuliani declared that the artwork was sick and blasphemous, and demanded cancellation of the show before it opened. He revoked $7 million in city funding for the museum and threatened to take away the museum's building. Giuliani claimed that it wasn't censorship, but rather a correct use of public funds. Only in 2019 did a court finally decide that these actions by the conservative politician were a violation of the museum's right to artistic freedom. The picture was subsequently defaced with white paint in New York. The planned fourth stop for the exhibition at the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra was called off by that museum. Donald Trump was among the few who supported Giuliani in his undemocratic effort to stifle artistic expression in 1999. Trump was then considering a run for the presidency for the first time, and he hoped that the city of New York would build an expressway that would improve the location for one of his construction projects. The possible candidate provided a statement to the tabloid newspaper Daily News. "As president, I would ensure that the National Endowment of the Arts stops funding of this sort." Apart from the mistake in the name of the NEA, instead of, it should be for, the newspaper noted correctly that the government cultural funding organization had not, in fact, provided any money at all for the sensation exhibition. Trump stated with respect to Ofili's picture, "It's not art. It's absolutely gross, degenerate stuff." The art magazine Art News opined on this choice of words. Note the word degenerate. There was, of course, another politician who used that adjective to describe works of art that offended him. The reference is to Adolf Hitler. Donald Trump maintained his personal opposition to the National Endowment for the Arts. Shortly after his election, he indicated that he might want to select Rambo star Sylvester Stallone as the new chairperson of the NEA, the organization that still provides some very low level of public funding to cultural institutions in the U.S., which otherwise depend entirely on private donations. Stallone, at least, paints some and owns a respectable art collection, works by Claude Monet, Francis Bacon, and German painter Anselm Kiefer, for example. When some straw fell off one of Kiefer's works, the actor simply glued it back on himself. Later he sold the large format piece for family reasons. "My wife thought it could make the children depressed." Diplomatically, but decisively, the actor turned down the cultural post. The NEA had its headquarters in the historic Old Post Office Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., in immediate proximity to the White House. After a consortium led by Donald Trump's investment company, DJT Holdings, LLC, was able to lease the 114-year-old building from the U.S. government beginning in 2013. The arts funding organization had to find new space because the building was to become a hotel after a $212 million makeover. The Trump International Hotel, Washington, D.C., opened with a media splash in September 2016 during the presidential election. The NEA had to relocate to a functional office complex in the southern part of the city. When Trump announced his plans for the hotel before construction began, he told the Daily Post, "Friends of mine, they spend these ridiculous amounts of money on paintings. I'd rather do jobs like this and do something really that the world can cherish and the world can see and that everyone in D.C. can truly be proud of." In budget plans, the Trump administration sought time and again to kill financing for the NEA, which had been only a more or less symbolic $30 million annually. Congress blocked this move for the fiscal year 2018-19 and voted to increase the NEA budget by $3 million. For 2020-21, the elimination of funding for the NEA was once again on Trump's agenda. Gold instead of Go. The reaction of the Guggenheim Museum in New York was appropriately sarcastic when the Trumps, who were moving into the White House, requested the loan of a painting by Vincent van Gogh. There was a long tradition of presidents being lent artworks from public collections. When her husband was elected president, Jacqueline Kennedy at once banished the dreary furniture from the Truman era and hung modern art on the walls of the White House. She asked the director of the nearby National Gallery, John Walker, for the loan of, among other items, four paintings by Paul Cézanne, and he agreed. In 1962, the First Lady had a documentary about the White House made for TV, in which she expressly referred to the pictures on the walls. That Jacqueline Kennedy knew something about art was no secret after the film. As First Lady, Hillary Clinton selected a painting by Georgia O'Keeffe, along with other works. Michelle Obama ensured that works especially by women and people of color graced the rooms of the White House. For her own collection of art in the White House, she had acquired, among other pieces, an abstract representation of a glowing, colorful circle in yellow, orange, and blue, which was to be hung above the table in the family dining room. The artist who created the painting, Alma Thomas, was the first black female artist to enter the White House collection. Among his selections, President Obama hung two works on loan from the Whitney Museum of American Art, paintings by Edward Hopper that depict not so much the American dream, but American loneliness. It isn't known why the White House, at the behest of Donald and Melania Trump, asked the Guggenheim specifically for Vincent van Gogh's Landscape with Snow, a view of Arles in the south of France that shows a lone rambler with his dog. The response by the curator, Nancy Spector, to the request, however, was no secret. The respected art historian replied to her professional colleague, Donna Hayashi Smith, at the White House, that unfortunately the request could not be granted. As the artist had agreed, she could offer, nonetheless, a different work of art. The 100-kilogram, 18-karat gold toilet that Maurizio Cattelan had fabricated. Should the President and the First Lady have any interest in installing it in the White House, it is, of course, extremely valuable and somewhat fragile, but we would provide all the instructions for its installation and care. Spector said that more than 100,000 people had already used the object while it was installed in the Guggenheim Museum in 2016-17. Now, she added, Cattelan was ready to offer it to the White House for a long-term loan. The evocative title of the work, America. Spector's witty, courageous, polysemous answer was at once taken by the public exactly as it had been intended, an affront to the sitting President of the United States and his empty slogan, Make America Great Again. A commentator on Fox, the TV network devoted to Trump, demanded the immediate resignation of the art historian. There was, however, no word from the presidential couple in the White House. The request to the Guggenheim and the gutsy reply to it remain as public symbols of the impaired relationship of the U.S. museum community to this art-phobic president, and not without reason. Broken promises. Conversely, the relationship of Donald Trump to the museum as an institution appears to have been permanently damaged early on. He refused to donate artworks that he had promised to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and instead had them destroyed, along with a venerable building that had played an important role in American art history. At that site, the intersection of Fifth Avenue and 56th Street in Manhattan, at which Trump constructed his prestige project, Trump Tower, between 1980 and 1982, the flagship store of the luxury department store chain Bonwit Teller & Company had earlier stood. The 1929 building was the work of the same architects who had designed Grand Central Terminal, Whitney Warren and Charles Wetmore. It was intended originally to house the women's department store Stewart. Bonwit Teller, who took over the building in 1930 and opened it anew, soon began working with world-famous artists. Starting in 1936, the Spanish surrealist artist Salvador Dalí regularly decorated the windows with spectacular installations, as he did, for example, in 1939, working with the theme Night and Day. In the 1950s, Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg worked for the company on the side as window dressers, using the pseudonym Matson Jones. Among other things, Johns displayed his now iconic painting Flag on Orange Field behind a mannequin in the windows in 1957. The same year, in the same place, Rauschenberg showed his Red Combine painting, along with others. 2 years earlier, the large photographic work Blue Ceiling, Matson Jones, could be seen in the background of the Bonwit Teller windows. In 1959, James Rosenquist was also working for the department store. A half century later, he recalled, "By the late 1950s, I'd begun to lead a double life. In the daytime, I painted billboards and designed display windows for Bonwit Teller, Tiffany, and Bloomingdale's. At night and on weekends, I hung out with artists and painted." In 1961, 5 large-format paintings by the then almost completely unknown artist Andy Warhol stood and were hung in the windows on Fifth Avenue. Warhol was then earning his living mostly with advertising assignments. Starting in 1951, with work for the Bonwit Teller display director, Gene Moore. At the time, this descendant of Carpatho-Rusyn immigrants was not taken seriously as a painter. 10 years later, Warhol changed his approach, putting his own works in the windows of Bonwit Teller, and his global career took off. Today, a museum director would kill for one of these paintings, among them the now-famous Blast, with its Superman theme, and Before and After One, which depicts a nose job. For more than 50 years, Bonwit Teller had an eye for the New York avant-garde art scene. As the scholarly publication The Art Story summarized the meaning of this New York art site, "Under Moore's direction, in the mid-century, Bonwit Teller gave many modern artists their starts in the world of art and design. With free creative rein, avant-garde artists experimented in the department store window, turning a glass case into an alternative art space and introducing the public to new and exciting styles." This part of the history of art and of New York City appears to have eluded Donald Trump. And that's not all. The developer wasn't even willing to save the artworks inside the building from destruction, breaking a promise to the renowned Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is nearby, because profit and time were dearer to him than culture. After all, Trump hadn't bought the Bonwit Teller building for $15 million in 1979, when the department store went bankrupt, in order to preserve an historical monument. He wanted to create a monument to himself, Trump Tower. The demolition was already decided upon when the contracts were signed, and the art that decorated the building was only of interest to the developer for a short time, when he believed that he could do some business with it and buff up his reputation. Trump's eternal principle when it comes to art. Close to the top of the 11-story building, there were 2 limestone relief panels of 2 nearly naked women brandishing large scarves, as if dancing, in which the Metropolitan Museum of Art had expressed a strong interest for its sculpture collection. The Metropolitan, one of the largest and most important museums in the world, had also wanted to add to its Department of Applied 20th Century Art the 6-by-9-meter geometric-patterned bronze latticework that hung over the entrance at Bonwit Teller. By all accounts, Trump had agreed to donate both, if his workers were able to remove them from the walls. The New York Times and the Washington Post reconstructed what happened next. Their investigations demonstrated that Trump hadn't just broken his promise and destroyed valuable art. The journalists discovered that, when his cultural crime caused an uproar, Trump hid behind a pseudonym and lied to the public. What followed was a display of arrogance, excuse-making, and avoidance of tough questions that is familiar to anyone who has observed Trump's interactions with the media throughout his campaign for the White House. When journalists asked the Trump Organization about the existence of the 2 limestone Art Deco friezes, a spokesperson going by the name John Barron replied that 3 independent experts had found that the works had no artistic value and were worth at most an estimated $9,000. According to Barron, the removal would have cost $32,000 and would have meant a week and a half delay of the demolition work. The alleged costs for the delay were later calculated by Trump's side to be $500,000. The next day, Barron was quoted as saying that the bronze latticework that had hung over the entrance to the Bonwit Teller building was also missing. "We don't know what happened to it." The artist Otto J. Tegan, who had designed the piece in 1930, responded, "It's not a thing you could slip in your coat and walk away with. It's odd that a person like Trump, who is spending $80 million or $100 million on this building, should squirm that it might cost as much as $32,000 to take down those panels. The journalists didn't give up searching for these artworks that had been promised to the American public. 3 days later, the New York Times wrote, "Repeated efforts over the last 3 days to reach Mr. Trump have been unavailing." On the fourth day, the real estate developer contacted the journalists and explained that he had ordered the destruction of the Bonwit Teller reliefs himself, because their removal could have cost more than $500,000 in taxes, demolition delays, and other expenses, and might have endangered passing pedestrians on Fifth Avenue. "My biggest concern was the safety of the people on the street below," said the 33-year-old developer, who contended that cranes, scaffolding, and the most careful handling could not have assured that the safe removal of the cracked and weathered 2-ton limestone panels from high on the building's facade. "If one of those stones had slipped," he said, "people could have been killed. To me, it would not have been worth that kind of risk." In truth, Trump's biographer, Harry Hurt III, confirmed Trump himself ensured that the workers were told to remove the bronze latticework over the entrance with blowtorches, separate the friezes from the walls with jackhammers, and break them off with crowbars, and throw them down into the interior of the building where they shattered into a million pieces. Ashton Hawkins, the vice president and secretary of the Board of Trustees of the Met, was among those outraged and told the New York Times in June 1980, "How extraordinary. I know that there was an offer of a gift in the event that the objects could be saved. I would think that would be sufficient to guide them in their actions. We are certainly very disappointed and quite surprised." Hawkins dismissed with a single sentence Trump's argument that the sculptures had no value. "Can you imagine the museum accepting them if they were not of artistic merit?" "The reliefs are as important as the sculptures on the Rockefeller building," elaborated the gallerist Robert Miller, who had assessed the reliefs. "They'll never be made again." Today, President Trump labels everything that doesn't conform to his political ideas fake news, but he had to admit that he had adopted a false identity to explain his point of view to the public. The alleged press spokesperson, John Barron, who sometimes called himself Barron and occasionally identified himself as the vice president of the Trump Organization, was none other than Trump himself. In a legal proceeding in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York in Manhattan concerning the illegal employment of Polish workers in the building of Trump Tower for $4 an hour, Trump admitted that he and one of his executives had used the name John Barron in some of their business dealings. Outside the courthouse, he explained confidently, "Lots of people use pen names. Ernest Hemingway used one." Sometimes Trump used the alias John Miller for statements, such as those claiming that famous women like Madonna or Kim Basinger supposedly wanted to meet him. In March 2006, Melania and Donald Trump named their son Barron. Two contemptuous statements Trump made later in 1980 show that the Bonwit Teller affair, which did long-term damage to his reputation in New York's intellectual circles, continued to trouble Trump. At an event in the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Manhattan, Trump, its owner, expressed his opinion about the table decorations made out of gold mylar and the lion's head medallions over the entrance to the ballroom. "Real art, not like the junk I destroyed at Bonwit Teller." And in the summer of that year, a New York Times story quoted Trump, "There is nothing that I would like to do more than give something to a museum," he said in a recent interview. "Why? I've always been interested in art." A visitor observed that there was no art in Mr. Trump's office. The developer considered this for a moment. Then, with a smile, he pointed to an idealized illustration of Trump Tower hanging on one of the walls. "If that isn't art," Mr. Trump said, "then I don't know what is." I just hate the Trumps. The skyscraper that in 1980 arose on the place where the Bonwit Teller building had earlier stood was planned from the beginning as a monument to its builder. It seemed swiftly to dawn on Donald Trump that collaboration with the person who, at the time, was the most important artist in the New York art scene, could glam up the meaning and reputation of the project, which had been damaged by the Bonwit-Teller affair. He knew Andy Warhol personally, since the two had met in February 1981 at a birthday party for the notorious lawyer Roy Cohn. In the 1950s, Cohn had been one of the closest advisors of the communist-hunting senator Joseph McCarthy. Later, Cohn counted among his clients not only Cosa Nostra bosses such as Anthony Salerno, Carmine Galante, and John Gotti, but also Donald Trump. After their first meeting, Mark Ballett, the art director of Warhol's magazine Interview, set up a visit to Warhol's famous factory. In his posthumously published diaries, the artist wrote afterwards, "Had to meet Donald Trump at the office. Cab, $5.50. Mark Ballett had set up this meeting. I keep forgetting that Mark gave up architecture to become an art director, but he still builds models at home. He told Donald Trump that I should do a portrait of the building that would hang over the entrance to the residential part. It was so strange. These people are so rich. They talked about buying a building yesterday for $500 million or something. He's a butch guy. Nothing was settled, but I'm going to do some paintings anyway and show them to them." A few weeks later, during a joint visit to the building site for Trump Tower by Ballett and Warhol, Warhol's assistant, Christopher Makos, photographed the models of the future building. In Warhol's studio, a series of paintings in black, silver, and gold were made. Some of them the artist coated in diamond dust. There wasn't a contract. Warhol, who was always conscious of money, nonetheless noted hopefully in his diary on June 1, 1981, "Mark's arranged it so that the catalog cover he's designing will be my painting, and then the Trumps would wind up with this painting of their building. It's a great idea, isn't it?" 2 months later, the dreams of a new big customer were shattered. On August 5th, Donald and Ivana Trump visited the factory again. The Trumps came down. Donald Trump and his wife and two ladies who work for him, I guess. "Mrs. Trump is 6 months pregnant." I showed them the paintings of the Trump Tower that I'd done. I don't know why I did so many. I did 8. In black and gray and silver, which I thought would be so chic for the lobby. But it was a mistake to do so many. I think it confused them. Mr. Trump was very upset that it wasn't color-coordinated. They have Angelo Donghia doing the decorating, so they're going to come down with swatches of material so I can do the paintings to match the pinks and oranges. I think Trump's sort of cheap, though. I get that feeling. And Mark Ballett, who set up the whole thing, was sort of shocked. But maybe Mrs. Trump will think about a portrait, because I let them see the portraits of Lynn Wyatt behind the building paintings, so maybe they'll get the idea. They did not. Not only did Trump not buy any of the Trump Tower paintings, he didn't commission a portrait from Warhol, who remained a mortal enemy of the developer from that point on. In May 1984, he recorded in his diary, "And I just hate the Trumps, because they never bought my Trump Tower portraits. And I also hate them because the cabs on the upper level of their ugly Hyatt Hotel just back up traffic so badly around Grand Central now, and it takes me so long to get home." 11 years later, the legendary architectural historian Herbert Muschamp attempted a reconciliation, at least with the work of the artist, who had died in the meantime. Muschamp had written a not altogether flattering piece about Trump International Hotel and Tower on Columbus Circle, still under construction, which, of course, the real estate developer didn't like. To smooth things over, the critic had invited Trump and his architect, Philip Johnson, for a conversation in the Museum of Modern Art in front of the famous Marilyn by Warhol that Johnson had donated to the museum. The meeting didn't turn out as expected. Muschamp's recollection, in any case, says much about Donald Trump's relationship to modern art. "A Wednesday morning before the museum is open. Winter, very cold. Mr. Johnson and I are waiting in the lobby. He's wearing his famous Astrakhan fur hat. Limousine pulls up. Very black. Mr. Trump gets out with 3 associates, gray and blonde, great color combination. But a terrible expression on his face. Pursed mouth, no smile. I'm going to get this guy. We head upstairs and clip through the galleries. When we reach the room where the Marilyn is hanging, I point it out. Philip gave that. Isn't it great? There's a large sculpture in the middle of the room, a brass floor piece by Donald Judd. Evidently, Mr. Trump mistakes it for a coffee table, for he uses it as one, tossing his overcoat and some binders full of pictures on top of it as we walk over to the painting. Mr. Trump barely glances at the Marilyn, but this doesn't matter. My goal is to capture them together in the same frame. He's a work of art himself, as well as a piece of work. A living self-portrait with a trademark signature sought by foreign banks, condo dwellers, autograph hounds, advertisers, and publishers. Warhol's dream was to live off putting his signature on soup cans. Mr. Trump has more or less fulfilled it. Trump, who plainly couldn't connect to Andy Warhol's art, didn't have a problem, many years later, with brazenly making use of the artist's ideas. If you like art and can't make money at it, you eventually realize that everything is business, even your art. That's why I like Warhol's statement about good business being the best art. It's a fact. That's also another reason I see my business as an art, and so I work at it passionately. A fake is a fake is a fake. There are also artworks in Trump's three-story apartment in Trump Tower. But first and foremost, there is a lot of tasteless, pretentious interior decoration. In his plans and purchases, the interior designer, Angela Dongia, you should feel at all times that what is around you is attractive, and that you are attractive, had channeled the style of the absolutist Sun King, Louis XIV of France. L'état, c'est moi. And most likely didn't grasp how closely he had modeled Trump's future style of government. Gold decoration everywhere, marble from the floor up to the ceiling, painted with themes from ancient mythology, plus mirrors, candelabras, crystal glass, gold serving trays, heavy pseudo-Baroque furniture, dark pillows with the family crest. The British journalist Peter York, the author of the book Dictator Style, Lifestyles of the World's Most Colorful Despots, comes to the conclusion, Trump's design aesthetic is fascinatingly out of line with America's past and present, but it also has important parallels, not with Italian Renaissance or French Baroque, where its flourishes come from, but with something more recent. The best aesthetic descriptor of Trump's look, I'd argue, is dictator style. The design of today's president fulfills the three principal criteria that defines the palaces of despots: monumentality, the unwitting and inept imitation of historical models, and the almost unconditional surrender to the style of absolutist France. Where there's still some room left for pictures in Trump's private New York apartment, they hang in heavy frames. A painting of Aurora and Apollo in a chariot of war over the fireplace. A family portrait in the next room, and before it a statue of Amor and Psyche. And then there is a painting that doesn't fit in with the others and has raised questions for years. If it's really an original by one of the most famous masters of French Impressionism, as Trump has claimed on many occasions, then it would be worth tens of millions. Originally, Pierre-Auguste Renoir's large-format representation of a young woman and a small girl with a basket of flowers must have hung on board Trump's private Boeing 727. That's where the then Playboy reporter Mark Bowden saw the picture when he once accompanied the businessman on a trip. His behavior was cringeworthy. He showed off the gilded interior of his plane, calling me over to inspect a Renoir on its walls, beckoning me to lean in closely to see, what, the luminosity of the brushstrokes? The masterly use of color? No. The signature. Worth 10 million, he told me. Trump's biographer, Tim O'Brien, reported a similar experience, speaking to Vanity Fair's podcast Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. He too saw the alleged Renoir painting when he boarded for his flight with Trump to Los Angeles and asked whether it was genuine. When Trump confirmed that it was, O'Brien answered, "No, it's not, Donald." Trump insisted that it was authentic. "Donald, it's not," the journalist repeated stubbornly. "I grew up in Chicago. That Renoir is called Two Sisters on the Terrace, and it's hanging on a wall at the Art Institute of Chicago. That's not an original." When Trump contradicted him again, O'Brien gave up pushing the issue. For Trump, though, it wasn't over. When the two of them boarded the next day to fly back to New York, Trump again pointed to the painting and explained, as if the conversation on the preceding day had never occurred, "You know, that's an original Renoir." In truth, Renoir's painting, Two Sisters on the Terrace, has hung in the Art Institute of Chicago since 1933. In her will, Annie Swan Coburn, the wife of an attorney, had left the 1881 painting to the museum, where it can still be seen today. What is plainly a copy of the picture no longer hangs in the plane, but in the Trump family apartment in Trump Tower. When the president-elect had his first interview after the election with the CBS News program 60 Minutes, the alleged Renoir could be seen hanging in the background. When Trump's wife Melania showed the apartment to a television team from Fox News, her tour included walking in front of the reproduction. In the New York office of the First Lady, there is also an elaborately framed Renoir picture, the portrait of a woman wearing an evening gown in a box at the theater. This is also a copy, without any doubt, since the original hangs in the gallery of the Courtauld Institute in London. Donald Trump appears never to have let himself be constrained by questions about authenticity and fakery. On a state visit to France in 2018, the U.S. president noticed several decorative artworks in the Hôtel de Pontalba, the residence of the American ambassador in Paris. A bust of the writer, inventor, and statesman Benjamin Franklin, a painted portrait of Franklin, and a group of small silver statuettes depicting figures from Greek mythology. He would be taking these works back to Washington on Air Force One, Trump explained, stunning the ambassador, Jamie McCourt, according to witnesses. McCourt had made financial contributions in support of Trump's 2016 election and in return had been named ambassador in 2017. The pieces would be returned at the latest in 6 years, at the end of his hoped-for second term, the president joked. The president brought these beautiful, historical pieces, which belong to the American people, back to the United States to be prominently displayed in the People's House, the White House spokesman Judd Deere said of the incident when it became public in fall 2020. Neither he nor his boss knew, however, that both the bust and the painting were copies of older originals. And the kitschy little figurines had been made by the Neapolitan artist Luigi Avolio, after 1900 in large editions, to be pawned off as authentic works from the 16th or 17th century. The London art dealer Patricia Wengraff called them 20th century fakes of wannabe 17th century sculptures, and said they weren't worth much. Trump, nonetheless, prominently displayed them on the mantle of the fireplace in the Oval Office. Sometimes Trump would tell guests at his club Mar-a-Lago the story that the builder of the place had commissioned Walt Disney personally to create the nursery rhyme-themed tiles in one of the rooms, which would later be used as a bedroom for his daughter Ivanka. But Disney was already working 2,700 miles away in Hollywood when Mar-a-Lago was built between 1924 and 1927. The supposedly original Disney tiles are no more genuine than the fake Time magazine cover that hangs in at least 5 of Trump's resorts. Trump evidently never developed a taste for the genuine works of art that hang at Mar-a-Lago. 16th-century Flemish tapestries had hung in the living room for decades, curtains protecting them from unnecessary exposure. But, according to his former butler, Anthony Senecal, Trump blasted the room with light. The centuries-old tapestries faded in the merciless Florida sun.